You're listening to the Psychedelic Invest podcast, where we speak with founders, CEOs, investors, advisors, experts, and thought leaders in the brave new world of psychedelics and entheogenic medicines. Brought to you by Psychedelic Invest, bringing you unparalleled psychedelic investing data and analysis. Psychedelic Invest is the industry's leading resource for those looking to invest in the burgeoning psychedelic industry. For more information and to access all of the podcast episodes, check out our website at psychedelicinvest.com/podcast. And now, here's the host of the Psychedelic Invest podcast, Bruce Eckfeld.
Welcome, everyone. This is the Psychedelic Invest podcast. I'm Bruce Eckfeld. I'm your host. Our guest today is Robert Anson. He is founder at Healing Hearts, Changing Minds. We're going to talk about the work that they're doing in psychedelics to really help develop this industry and develop solutions for folks that are looking to find the benefits to use these therapeutic models to address a whole host of issues, really trying to help navigate these things. And I think really kind of looking at where we are as a market in terms of helping people understand, now move into helping people find resources, use resources, really kind of apply them to day-to-day life and the things that the challenges people are having, you know, both large and small, and really kind of get the benefit of these therapeutics. So excited for the conversation with Robert, excited to understand background, how he got into this space, really like what they're trying to do, what successes they've had, maybe some challenges, and then where they kind of see the market going or where they see this industry going. So with all that, Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bruce. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Before we get into everything you're doing today, I would love to get a little background on you. Like, how did this come about? Like, I'm curious about your kind of introduction to psychedelics. What's the backstory to all this?
Isn't it great, Bruce, how we each have our own crazy story?
Yeah, I know.
Like, how did it possibly lead to this?
Uh-huh.
So I was a real estate developer focused on something called adaptive reuse, which is basically sort of buying and adapting beautiful old industrial buildings into mixed use complexes.
Uh-huh.
Loved it. I got into it because my family were shoemakers, interestingly. My grandfather was a shoemaker, my dad was a shoemaker, and I grew up in one of these great big mills in Massachusetts.
Fascinating, yeah.
And I loved it, you know, triple bottom line, leading on the environment, really trying to help uplift some of these sort of depressed communities. And literally, I remember looking up at the sky in 2006 and just loving my life and just saying, wow, universe, I must have been a real winner in a past life to have this kind of karma.
Yeah.
You know, just killing it on all fronts. And then, boom, the Great Recession hit not long thereafter. And I'll never forget it. Just nothing was going right. And I remember, you know, maybe a year later, looking up at the same set of clouds, just saying, what the hell?
Why did you do this to me?
What did I do? You know, it's like, as everybody knows, you know, that feeling of sort of going from being the pretty boy to the ugly boy, and I didn't do anything different.
Uh-huh.
So that was a really challenging period. But as I'm sure a lot of your listeners in business can understand it, the hardest times are sometimes the most beneficial. Mm-hmm. And they really taught me who I was and what I was able to do and withstand. And you really get to see who's good at something when the clouds come over the horizon and the waves hit and you're in a real storm. And so we were able to sort of weather that tsunami. And I was able to get out of kind of these big projects that I had underway. But it stopped being fun, you know, and that was the most important thing to my success was I loved what I did in development and it really became a job. And so 2012 came around, the market changed. All of a sudden, I was the pretty boy again, had an opportunity to finish some huge projects. By 2015, I decided to start selling. And selling assets and taking money off the table. And I sort of noticed that the more I sold, the less risk I had, the better I slept.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, my Ambien consumption went down. And so as of 2015, I sort of was in kind of retirement, sort of early retirement, licked my wounds, sort of thinking about what was next and started to take kind of a deeper dive into spirituality. And I always, from the time I was young, was just fascinated with some of those big questions, like, what are we doing here? And who am I? And, you know, those sorts of things. And I just never bought into either the sort of full-on scientific reasoning for why we're here, you know, a big bang and 13 billion years later, here we are, right? I never bought into that. And I never bought into sort of the traditional religious explanations either. So I just, and I felt like there was something pushing me to read and learn.
Interesting.
So that sort of path led me pretty quickly to start to really do a deeper dive into kind of comparative religions, a lot of time with some guides like Alan Watts, sure. Ram Dass. And it just all started to make sense. And I started reading about these things called near-death experiences. And I found them so interesting, you know, people who had flatlined and come back to talk about it, sort of talking about having experienced something that was so ineffable, and it just changed their lives. And so I thought, man, if I had that kind of proof, you know, sort of really changed my life and give me purpose, knowing that a lot of what I knew when I was a child, that there's more going on than maybe meets the eye. But I didn't want to flatline, right? That wasn't appealing to me at all. So
rough way to get there.
As fate would have it, a complete stranger, I was in a doctor's office for the first time, and I had this really sort of interesting conversation about where my life was and what was going on. And he said, you know, you may want to read this book. And the book was the Pollen book, mm-hmm. you know, How to Change Your Mind. And so I read it, and it just truly blew my mind. And I started researching these psychedelics, and I came across a study that said those who had a mystical experience with psychedelics were reporting almost identical findings as those who had a near-death experience. And I thought, aha, I know these things are safe. I know these things, albeit they may be scary. The science says that they're, you know, safer than pretty much anything.
Yep.
So I found a legal retreat in Jamaica. Literally October of 2019, I filed for divorce from my second wife, which was sort of a train wreck. Uh-huh. I say respectfully.
Yep.
Because I'm being recorded. And
well done.
Right. Thank you. And in November, I went to Jamaica and I followed the rules. I went with an intention. Mm-hmm. And my intention was I wanted to have what I call my George Harrison, my sweet Lord moment. I wanted to have irrefutable proof that sort of little Bobby was right, that there uh-huh. is a creator, there is an intelligence. And on the third and final journey with a ridiculous amount of psilocybin mushrooms, it happened. It happened at the very end of this 6-hour torturous, writhing in the sand trip mm-hmm. on the banks of the water in Jamaica. And Bruce, it was a flash. It was literally a flash that I'll never forget. I'm getting goosebumps as I tell you. And it came right through the top of my head, right into my head and into my heart. And in that split 1/1,000,000,000th of a second, I was never going to be the same person. And until then, I didn't know what the term awakening meant. I didn't know what the term rebirth meant. But all of a sudden, it was the missing piece, Bruce, to my life. Yeah. And to say it blew my mind is such an understatement. But I just knew that second that I knew who I was. I knew that everything had happened for a reason. I knew that, you know, it couldn't have happened any sooner than it did. Mm-hmm. I knew that even the two trips I had had in Jamaica that week had to have happened for me to finally reach this crescendo moment. Well, as I started to sort of process this experience over the days and weeks to follow, my entrepreneurial brain just turned back on. For the first time in years, it just, boom, it was on. And I couldn't help but have these kind of two main revelations. The first was, I just didn't know that this type of healing was possible in this world, that this incredible healing potential existed. And now I'd had the experience, so I couldn't deny it. Mm-hmm. And the second was, how do we bring this to the communities where the trauma is?
Okay.
Right? How do we create a model that delivers the kind of healing experience that I had that cost about 10 grand, right? How do we make that accessible for people who can't afford a week off to go to Jamaica and spend 10 grand?
Yeah, exactly.
And to me, as somebody who from the time I was really young, you know, my number one goal in life was I wanted to help make this world a better place. That was what little Bobby wanted to do. And I think I started giving up on that as I got beat up, as I got sort of tossed and turned and raped again and again. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I just felt like, oh.
Just clicked.
Yeah, this is too important. And so this happened right before COVID. So 2020, together with the rest of the world, we all learned about how effective and incredibly intelligent these viruses are. Mm-hmm. Right? And my brain was, again, in overload, you know, sort of overdrive, trying to figure out, okay, what's the right model, how to go about this? And, you know, one of the things I learned in my readings from people like Alan Watts was that we live in a world of opposites, right? You have to have the yin to have the yang. You have to have the black to have the white. And I couldn't help but think, you know, so if we have these viruses, if nature teaches us that we have these things that can deliver something that's awful really efficiently, imagine if we could use the power of sort of that intelligence to deliver something that's really good and that can become viral within a community, but not to spread disease, but to spread things like healing. And that jazzed me. That just really excited me on every level. And it occurred to me, why don't we have a word for a good virus? You know, why does a virus have to be a bad thing?
Yeah.
And so I went on a listening tour. I learned about this brand new industry. You know, here I am, a real estate developer learning
about.
I mean, it was kind of crazy. And I'm still sort of finding my way along because the mix of characters is so foreign to me. You know, you've got people who've been in this for decades. You've got scientists now. You've got investors. You've got people like me who didn't expect maybe to have the kind of experience we had. And you can't ignore it. You just can't. I know that this is my purpose. I know that I'm back in the driver's seat of my life. I feel like I reconnected with little me and was able to sort of literally process the trauma that was preventing me from living my best life. So ultimately, that led to Healing Hearts, Changing Minds. I wrote a check for over $1 million to this effort. And you and I talked a little bit before the recording about how important timing is. Mm-hmm. You know, real estate, they say it's location, location, location. Bullshit. Yep. It's timing. It's timing first. I mean, you can have the greatest location in the world. And if a great recession happens, like, it kind of doesn't matter. So our timing was really good. You know, sort of we funded this thing. We came to market saying we've got real dollars and we want to help support the best leaders in this space who are helping to bring this healing during a drought. You know, the markets had shifted so quickly. Literally, the public markets had soured to the tune of maybe 90, 95%. And it really felt like we were sort of going to a drought, a desert that had been under a drought for some time and saying, hey, we've got some real beautiful cold water. Mm-hmm. We created an RFP. Well, first thing we did was we identified the leaders from within the segment of the market we wanted to address. You know, I just wanted to help anybody, but of all of the sort of traumatized communities, the one that really was most personal for me, and I wanted to start sort of small and test our model, was the queer community. Mm-hmm. And the reason is pretty straightforward. In the 1970s, my mentor, you know, the person who more than any other was kind of the son that I revolved around, my dad, was outed as a gay man.
Yeah.
And that had a profound impact on me. Not that he was outed, but watching this, you know, sort of head of industry, this philanthropist, this mm-hmm. just tremendous human being, embrace his new identity, embrace his new tribe, and immediately went about saving lives during the AIDS epidemic.
Wow.
And I was just so proud of him and quickly learned, you know, it's hard for us to look back on it and remember now, but in the 70s, being openly homosexual was not anything like it is today. Mm-hmm. And so that had a profound impact, and watching my dad literally put everything on the line and say, this is what we do with our lives. You know, we were given a certain amount of energy. I choose to use my energy to help make the world a better place. And to watch him lead when it was not, it was far from politically correct.
Oh, yeah.
Really opposite. Had a, yeah. Totally. So it was personal because of my dad. And then most recently, you know, interesting how the universe always tends to give you what you need, right?
Not necessarily what you want.
No. And sometimes they can be both. I mean,
yeah, sometimes
you don't realize it at the time, right?
Yeah.
But the curveball that I was thrown was my oldest child. I have two beautiful children, 22 and 18. And my oldest, who was born Isabella, came out first as gay and then as non-binary.
Yeah.
And has transitioned from my Isabella to our Indigo.
Yeah.
And I've really sort of been able to see through their eyes how much more work we have to do in this world of just accepting people for who they are and allowing people to live their own truths. And I've been really proud of Indy, watching how Indy has picked up, you know, their grandpa's mantle and has become a leader in their community. And so I said, look, this is the community I want to start with. And it turns out that the LGBT community really needed sort of the attention and needed the recognition that very little has been done to sort of bring these medicines to that community, starting with the scientific community, you know, with these clinical trials. I identified, you know, with my team, sort of the leaders bringing these services to the queer community, and quickly found out that literally things like ketamine are saving people's lives.
Yeah, I'm fascinating. Like, I guess, how is it working? Like, what are you noticing as the kind of therapeutic benefit, or what is this facilitating, are you finding with folks? And I guess, is it similar or different than your experiences with psilocybin?
It's a great question. So I came at the topic of ketamine with very much a bias. And my bias was based on a lot of people saying, look, it's not a traditional psychedelic. Mm-hmm. It has the potential for abuse. Uh-huh. The way that it's being distributed perhaps has a lot of people too sort of become addicted to it.
Yep.
And my experience was with psilocybin. And so I was just thinking, man, I mean, it has to be psilocybin. Well, talking to these leaders on the front lines of working with the queer population, you know, people with depression, people with PTSD, people with suicidality. And I just kept on hearing, Robert, not only is ketamine as good as some of these traditional psychedelics, it's better than traditional psychedelics for some of the most important needs, starting with preventing people from killing themselves.
Yeah.
Like literally.
Yeah. Keeping people alive, kind of step one.
Keeping people alive.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I heard that from enough people to realize that this really is part of the toolkit. And oh, by the way, it's legal today.
Yeah, prescribable and
today, everywhere in the country. So I don't know why ketamine sort of is not being used in a similar way as sort of the place in Jamaica that I went. You know, I don't know why they aren't kind of dosing people in a beautiful setting with groups that, you know, allow you to incorporate all important talk therapy.
Yep.
I don't know, but I do know that, you know, we are a ways away still, despite what you read. It's going to take a long time before traditional psychedelics really become legal and then sort of accessible by the masses. And I don't want to lose one person.
Yeah.
To me, and the reason is this, it's not that I'm high and mighty Mr. Morals. It's as simple as this, Bruce. I want to help change the world to be a better place. And to me, it's going to take healing people to do that. And if we want change agents who were born to be a change agent but haven't been able to be because they're depressed or because they're stymied because of their traumas, then we have to heal those healers. And sometimes it's just one person who's able to be their true selves who can literally change the world. So I don't want to wait for sort of everything, all of these other psychedelics to come online. We have ketamine today. We've learned, and this has really helped to inform what we're doing with Healing Hearts, the delivery of these therapies for these communities is key. And what I mean by that is, especially because of the history of these psychedelics and how effective the government vilified these substances, it's really important that we have, for each of these traumatized communities, those from within these communities who have benefited to be the ones who are welcoming others from the community to find that healing themselves. really critical. So in other words, you need queer facilitators saying, I understand your trauma. I come from the same small town where I was kicked out of my family. Yep. And I get that. And look at where I am now. So trust me. Interestingly, it's very similar to sort of the AA model, you know, which I haven't heard others talking about, which is, you know, the final step of the 12-step program with AA is you found your way to healing, which in the case of AA is you're not drinking. And your job is then to spread that message of healing to others. And isn't it interesting that part of the benefit of spreading that message of healing and helping others heal is you're more likely to stay on the healing path if you're helping other people to heal.
Yeah, you create community around it.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I guess how much do you feel, I mean, it clearly you've gone through a fairly, you know, significant, I won't say dramatic, but significant kind of transformation or experience, you know, personally with psychedelics that have, you know, put you down this path, you know, in an extremely clear and kind of focused way. I guess, how much do you feel like you've been able to kind of leverage some of the, I don't know, professional insight, kind of life insight in your previous professional kind of endeavors into psychedelics? And where, I guess I'm curious, what's transferred, what hasn't transferred? Where have you kind of had to learn and flex and rethink things for yourself? What has that process been like?
So I'm a big believer in something that Carl Jung talked about, which is, you know, you have to fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I did that as an entrepreneur, as a developer. You know, I had no idea. I got out of college knowing, right? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's laughable. They send you out into the world knowing very, very, very little about sort of anything. And, but you figure it out. And little by little, you start to become an expert. And the most important thing is to have that fire in the belly, I feel, is to have that vision of where you want to go. And there's not a lot of shortcuts. For me, it's jumping in and it's figuring things out. You know, so one thing I did learn from being an entrepreneur starting in my 20s was I learned to be smarter. I learned, for example, that, look, whenever you can align your goals with the way the wind is blowing, that's the way to go. Always easier to sail than it is to row. And again, that's partly timing. And so I think of what I was doing back in the mid-90s, working on sort of sustainable development and how difficult that was then. They just weren't talking about things like sustainable environmentally friendly development. You go to Home Depot and there might be one shelf of sustainable, right, lighting equipment. And now you go and it's the same or old school, not sustainable lighting equipment, right?
So yeah, that's the one shelf. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I feel like I'm much smarter in terms of ready, aim, fire than when I was young. You just want to start firing. And I fired a lot, wasted a lot of ammunition, but I know that the most important thing in growing any business are the people. And I feel like bringing my expertise, bringing my experience in real estate, but not even just real estate. I feel like most businesses are pretty much the same, maybe 80% of businesses the same. You have to have that CEO and understanding of how important the team is and the flexibility of the team and understanding the difference between marketing and advertising. I find so many businesses don't understand that. Interestingly, Bruce, I find that in psychedelics today. You know, I can't tell you how many people I run across who are, you know, leading the charge in psychedelics and they're convinced that they're in the psychedelics business. And I tell them, look, it reminds me of what they talk about, how the railroad businesses almost went out of business because they were convinced they were in the railroad business.
Yeah.
You know, it was only until they realized that, no, they're in the transportation business that they finally changed their ways. And I feel like those of us that understand the potential of psychedelic assisted therapy, we're in the mental health business. We're not in the psychedelics business. This is just another tool.
Yeah. Happens to be a tool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess, what does success look like for you? I guess, where do you want things to go? Like, what impact do you want to have, like, over the, you know, the next couple of years, say?
So, When I started this year or two ago, it was obvious to me that most of the attention from the time sort of the government allowed these molecules to be tested again until recently, almost all the focus has been, do they work?
Yeah.
Do the molecules work? And it seems to me that we now have ample evidence they do. You know, there's more testing to be done, obviously, but we know that they do. To me, I'm excited about not the potential energy of these therapies, but how do we convert that potential into the kinetic energy of helping to make the world a better place? Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is we started by making monies available. We got 50 proposals for our first grant round, really good proposals. And we selected 7 of what we felt were the best organizations poised to respond to this RFP. Mm-hmm. In our case, we started with wanting to help identify the leaders who are helping to train queer facilitators, because that's one of the bottlenecks in psychedelics is we just don't have enough of the facilitators, and specifically those, as I mentioned before, facilitators who are actually from the communities where the trauma exists.
Yeah.
So we ended up selecting this really wonderful group of organizations that ranged from, you know, large institutions like Berkeley, Columbia, to small little nonprofits that are just getting it done despite their tiny budget, despite their lack of sort of credentials, and are just doing incredible work. By the way, I think of all of these people doing this work as angels, who are literally saving lives. And now in 2024, we're really working to develop this collaboration between Healing Hearts and each of these grantee partners. We're hiring a project evaluation consultant, a really well-known academic researcher, to work with these grantees to gather as much of the data as we can, what works, what doesn't work, and ultimately document each program and how we went about doing this, and to create these win-wins where these organizations find value from what we're doing. You know, they are our market, and hopefully they'll want to continue to support what we're doing. They're going to support what we're doing, and together, you know, some real synergies exist. So ultimately, I've made a commitment that I'm going to fund the operation of this foundation moving forward, mm-hmm. so that, you know, I don't have the kind of resources that will allow me to continue to plow money in as I've done to date, meaning, you know, sort of the millions that it's going to take. But what I am doing is I'm making a commitment that I will fund the operation of Healing Hearts so that donor dollars can go 100% towards the organizations that are selected for these grants. And I didn't feel comfortable raising money right out of the gate until I had something that really worked, that was proven. And so to me, that meant I needed to spend my own money. I needed to bring that risk curve down. And once we have real data and we can show the funding community that, look, the model that we're pursuing, again, to bring this healing to the community level is cost effective and it works, at that point, we'll start fundraising and hopefully developing partnerships with larger funders and foundations.
Yeah. Robert, this is amazing. If people want to find out more information about you, more about Healing Hearts, Healing Minds, what's the best way to get that information?
Sure. So our website is healingheartsminds.org. And my email address is Robert Anson, A-N-S-I-N, at healingheartsminds.org. And plenty of information on the website about what we do. And we're really looking forward to adding to the website. And we're really looking for people who find alignment with what we're doing. And Bruce, like you, I understand now, finally, that the meaning of life is not how much shit we have, right? And how many cars we have and our titles. Uh-huh. You and I both know that if you want to have goosebumps, then it means being of service to others. And that is what really I'm selling. I want to spread the joy that I feel every day of helping other people find healing. And not just for themselves, but for their communities, so that we can then help them to be of service to others. And that's how you spread that virus I talk about. And that to me is a legacy. So anybody interested in helping us do this, I promise we are small, we're nimble, we have a very small staff, but we would love anybody who hears this, who's even a little interested in, hey, I do this, I do that, maybe I can help you. Please get in touch and we'd love to find a spot for you.
I love it. I'll make sure all the information is in the show notes so people can get that.
Fantastic.
Robert, yeah, thank you so much for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure.
Bruce, I really appreciate what you do. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Psychedelic Invest podcast. If you liked this episode, please be sure to leave a 5-star rating and leave us a review. You can find more episodes on all the major podcasting platforms and our website at psychedelicinvest.com/podcast.